From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy, broadcasting this week from Monroe, Louisiana. State of Belief airs every weekend on radio stations nationwide and is available as a podcast on iTunes and other leading podcast platforms. I urge you to subscribe to it. You can do it today. This program is made possible in great part by the generous support of our listeners. If you've made a donation this week, I really want to say a very sincere thank you. If you haven't pitched in yet, information on how you can help keep this show on the air is available at stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. Now, here's what's coming up this week on State of Belief Radio.
Good health is one of the keys to long life. As such, World Health Day has been set aside to bring awareness to the importance of healthy living. World Health Day is observed on Sunday, April 7th.
Sunday, April 7th is World Health Day. While a lot of progress has been made in some of the most desperately under-resourced parts of the world, there is so much more that needs to be done. And faith-inspired organizations have long played a key role in these efforts. On this week's show, we'll talk about problems and priorities in the area of human health and well-being with clean water activist and philanthropist David Douglas.
May we make whole the broken, returning peace and pride. May we treasure all the preciousness of life. May we transcend the darkness and reach for the divine. Please hear us. May your light shine. Shine on me.
Neshama Karlova is a Grammy-nominated musician, activist, and teacher who brings social consciousness and a passion for interreligious collaboration to her work and her life, and has just released her 10th album, which is titled Believe. Needless to say, I'm really looking forward to having Neshama Karlova with us later on this week's show. But first,
Hungary has declared its commitment to the revitalization of Christian civilization, all the while Poland has formally declared Jesus Christ as Lord and King over their nation. In the Russian Federation, the Orthodox Church has risen to a prominence not seen since the days of the Tsars. And in Latin America,
a couple of weeks ago, award-winning investigative journalist Sarah Posner was on this show discussing the wholesale export of American culture wars rhetoric to fragile democracies around the globe. Sarah had attended the so-called World Congress of Families in Moldova last year and shared some of the chilling rhetoric she heard there. Well, last week, the WCF reconvened in Verona, Italy, and the rhetoric was more toxic than ever. For a look at what happened and what's at stake, I'm joined by Peter Montgomery, senior fellow at People for the American Way and a courageous chronicler of the political religious right with whom I always enjoy talking. Peter, welcome back to State of Belief Radio.
Thank you, Weldon. Always great to be with you.
The connection between the World Congress of Families and atrocities such as the Ugandan Kill the Gays Bill, the Russian anti-gay law, and other institutional assaults on human rights is undisputed. This is not an academic matter. We're talking now real life.
You know, this is a network of activists and organizations that are actively engaged in promoting harmful legislation. Brian Brown, who heads the WCF and its parent organization, you know, was actually in Russia lobbying on behalf of legislation to ban gay couples from adopting, and they've supported the anti-gay propaganda law in Russia that has been used to prosecute teachers and activists and other people. So there's definitely a real harm that's caused by the folks in this network.
Peter, how dominant is the American political religious right in this organization?
Well, it's interesting. The American religious right plays an important role. Brian Brown also heads the National Organization for Marriage, very active anti-LGBTQ activist. He runs the show, but it also is very strongly connected to culture warriors from Russia and Vladimir Putin-aligned oligarchs, as well as activists from around the world. When the parent organization of the World Congress of Families sort of rebranded a couple of years ago as the International Organization for the Family, they had right-wing activists from Europe and Africa, the same kind of collection of global right-wing politicians and political leaders and organizational leaders that we see at the global summits, like the one that was just in Italy, mm-hmm. and also at regional conferences that they have during the year.
Who gives them money?
It's not very transparent exactly where they get their money, but it's clear that, there are organizations that are listed as sponsors in the past. That has included big U.S. organizations like the Alliance Defending Freedom. Sometimes local host governments or organizations connected to local host governments help to support the gatherings with money by providing spaces. So I think this time they were invited in by some right-wing politicians in Verona, Italy, and presumably got some help through them, through the local sponsors, with raising money. They've also raised money from this guy nicknamed God's Oligarch, Konstantin Malofiev, who is a Putin-aligned and extremely devout Russian Orthodox billionaire who uses his money to promote the interests of Putin and the Russian Orthodox hierarchy. And he has been involved in funding the World Congress of Families, among many other right-wing groups and movements in Eastern Europe and elsewhere.
Why Putin? Why those particular people? What's their reason for doing that?
Well, I think for Putin and Russia, part of their investing in right-wing groups in Eastern Europe is that they have been trying to weigh in those countries on behalf of local political leaders who are more aligned with Russia and who are opposed to the European Union and opposed to those countries being closer to the European Union, which they see as decadent and secularist. And, you know, Putin has portrayed himself and Russia as sort of saviors of Western civilization and Christendom. And, you know, particularly when Barack Obama was the U.S. president and promotion of reproductive choice and LGBTQ equality were part of our foreign policy, the American religious right groups just flocked to Putin, looking to him as really the lion of Christianity and the savior. And if Hillary Clinton had been elected a president, that would certainly be continuing. They haven't had as much of a need to embrace Putin so fully since Donald Trump got elected, because now they have an ally in the White House as opposed to opponent.
I see. Peter, talk about some of what was said at the World Congress of Families gathering in Verona, Italy last week, where the theme was winds of change. Is the Catholic Church complicit in this nefarious work?
Well, the Catholic hierarchy has been connected with the World Conference of Families. At last year's summit in Moldova, the Vatican Secretary of State actually came and attended. And that was a coup for them in a way, is to have someone that high ranking involved. My understanding is that in Verona, the World Congress of Families was invited there partly because Verona is a very conservative Catholic city. It has very conservative politicians. It's kind of a stronghold for both right-wing politics and right-wing Catholicism in Italy. And that's plays a big part in how the WCF got there. And certainly within Western Europe particularly, it is conservative Catholics who play an enormous role in anti-abortion, anti-LGBT organizing, the same way that in the United States, evangelicals play a really large role along with conservative Catholic allies.
Peter, this group has played a role in bringing anti-democratic reactionary regimes to political power in a number of countries. That's an incredible level of influence. What do you discern is their next target?
That is an interesting question. I think they are really looking to make progress in Europe right now, I think, by helping to elect right-wing representatives to the European Parliament, by helping to support right-wing parties and candidates throughout Western Europe. You know, we have, alongside of this organizing, we have a rise in anti-immigrant right-wing populist parties. And so there's kind of an unfortunate synergy happening. And so I think they're really hoping to strengthen these nationalist movements that are resisting the European Union, resisting the European Union's progressive policies on gender and sexuality and family, and really try to strengthen what they see as traditional values advocates. And then, you know, they certainly are going to continue to support that work throughout the rest of the world. At the end of this week, on Thursday and Friday, some of the same people who were in Italy for the World Congress of Families headed down to Bogota, Colombia, where another organization called the Political Network for Values, which focuses on legislators sharing information and strategies, was getting together for its, they call theirs a transatlantic summit. It is just more of this global culture war organizing that's going on, you know, at every level. And this network was specifically designed to bring together legislators to advance these kind of policies. You know, they have met in the past in New York at the United Nations. They've met in Brussels. And so they are also part of this global movement. You know, and right now, the United States is really the ally in this. I was recently at an event in Washington, D.C. at the Museum of the Bible, which was a gathering of conservative Hispanic evangelicals. And one of them, a man named Alfonso Aguilar, who is affiliated with the Alliance Defending Freedom, bragged about how they were working with the Trump administration to resist the work of the Organization for American States and the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights because they were supporting things that these culture warriors didn't like. And since then, the Trump administration and Mike Pompeo have announced cuts in funding to OAS and its agencies because they say they are promoting abortion. And so that is just one more way in which, you know, we are harming the lives of women, specifically in Latin America.
Peter, what's the end game here? You're an expert. What are the long-term goals of this whole movement?
Well, I would say that the long-term goals of this movement are to have laws and public policy in every nation reflect their interpretation of a biblical worldview. That would mean laws and policies that support their very conservative traditional views of gender roles, of education, of family, of sexuality, all those things. And they also are hoping to basically, for want of a better word, outbreed the liberals and secularists. One of the remarkable speakers at Verona is a guy named Steve Turley, who's an author and a blogger. And he went to give some encouraging news to the folks in Verona to say, we conservative religionists have babies at so much of a higher rate as the secularists that the secularists are going to just dwindle in the coming decades. And he predicted a future for America that is evangelical, Mormon, and Amish. So that's one end game.
Are there organizations that are effectively pushing back against some of these awful campaigns? What steps can people of goodwill who are disturbed by hearing about this kind of organizing, which subverts both democracy and religion, take?
Well, I think one way is to stay engaged, to support, you know, both politicians and advocates, the organizations that defend human values and democratic values, and because that's what it's going to take. I mean, one of the interesting things that happened in Verona was that there was a tremendous amount of progressive organizing in opposition to the World Congress of Families coming there, and there were literally tens of thousands of people in the streets protesting and defending the rights of women and LGBT people and democratic values. And so I think, you know, supporting organizations that do that kind of organizing and to get involved in trying to support candidates who reflect your values, that's what we've got to do.
Well, Peter, before we go, I know People for the American Way has just released an important new report regarding the appointments of judges. This has an impact on every aspect of American life, and so I would appreciate it if you would take a minute or two to talk about this report and let our listeners know how they can get their hands on it.
Yeah, that's great. I appreciate that. It's an excellent report. We've been doing a series of things called Confirmed Judges, Confirmed Fears. And it's basically trying to document in real time all the damage that is being done by the far-right judges that Trump has nominated and that the U.S. Senate under Mitch McConnell have rubber-stamped and rushed on to the federal courts. And, you know, unfortunately, some of these people are going to be with us for, you know, conceivably 30 or even 40 years. So we want to document the harm they're doing so that people can understand the importance of the federal courts and how much damage could be done when we put the power to nominate and approve judges in right-wing hands. People can get that report from People for the American Way's website, which is pfaw.org. And the digital and organizing team has put together, to go along with it, an excellent toolkit that will actually give people some concrete ways to share the information and to use it for their own organizing. And so I think the combination of the report and the toolkit is really a great piece of both information and advocacy.
Peter Montgomery is a senior fellow at People for the American Way. As a writer and researcher, he has spent many years exposing the political religious right in this country and beyond. Thank you for what you do. And thank you for being with us again on State of Belief Radio.
Thanks again for having me, Welton.
There's lots more still to come on this week's show. We'll mark World Health Day, April 7th, with activist and philanthropist David Douglas. And up next, Grammy-nominated musician Neshama Karlaba. I'm Welton Gaddy. You're listening to State of Belief Radio, brought to you by Interfaith Alliance. She's the daughter of the late musician Shlomo Karlaba, the legendary rock star rabbi. With numerous Grammy nominations and a track record of best-selling albums of her own, Neshama Karlaba has followed a unique and uniquely inspiring career path across musical genres and religious traditions. The new album is titled Believe, and I am delighted that it brings her to State of Belief Radio. Neshama, welcome.
Thank you so much. It's an honor to be here.
Your husband, a Menachem Creditor, was on our show a couple of years ago talking about his work with the Concert Across America to End Gun Violence. Have you been involved in this campaign as well?
I am so proud of my husband, and I'm so moved and inspired by the efforts always to bring people together and stop violence. for all of humanity. And yes, I feel very blessed that I've been a part of his effort and that I gave one of my songs to a recording to support that as well.
There are more Concert Across America dates coming up later this year. We'll link to the schedule from stateofbelief.com. But creating unity and change through music has clearly been such a theme of your career. So I want to ask you the same question I ask Rabbi Creditor. Why music? What is so unique about this way of being able to reach people?
Yes. Well, music is really the language of the soul. Where words fail us, where our intentions are often confused even in our own hearts, music transcends all borders and barriers and really allows people to find common ground. One song in harmony can bring a whole world together where issues can divide them in a million ways. And I've had the privilege, as I travel through the world with my interfaith choir, to seeing people come together in one space who never knew each other, who maybe would not agree on any issue, and then somehow crying and dancing and singing together, and in some way where our own best intentions fail us, music can set us free.
Is there something about your own religious background that focuses on this power that music uniquely has?
I mean, I love my own Jewish background is a source of joy and comfort to me always, but I really think that all religions, all great leaders, all great teachers, all of them are always constantly saying the same thing, that we are all the same, that we are all one, that no matter what path we walk, we are walking toward the same end, toward the same lights, and loving each other and loving our children is the only way. So I don't believe that the Jews are unique. I think that we all have to be unique as we are, but I think that we're all in the same place. I would hope that we're all in the same place, that we all want the same thing for the betterment of our worlds.
Your new album is called Believe. I'd like for you to just pick one song and briefly talk about why you included it in this project, and then we'll hear a little bit of that song.
So on this record, one of my most favorites is a song called How Long, which is really a cry to the heavens where we are imploring the universe to really help us create change. How long until we love each other? How long until we get it together, until people no longer have to be crying in the world? For me, song is always prayer. Music is prayer. And I hope that this song reaches people and somehow inspires them in this way as well.
All it takes is a moment to turn things around. All it takes is a moment to feel love abound. I want to feel that feeling. I want to know that place. I want to hear the answers. I want to see your face. How long till we give love unconditionally? Till we see each love as holy? Till we get there, will we get there? Till we take your words to heart?
We need to take another break now, but I'll talk more with musician Nasheeba Karliba in just a few minutes. And later, World Health Day progress and priorities with activist and philanthropist David Douglas. Now look, if you miss any part of today's program, you can hear full episodes of State of Belief anytime on our website. You'll also find links to the topics we discussed this week, extended interviews and transcripts, and an archive of past shows, all of that at stateofbelief.com. I'm Welton Gaddy. You're listening to State of Belief Radio, religion and radio done differently.
How long till we give love on?
Nishima, I think there is something so beautifully inclusive about the name of your latest album, and I wish you'd talk about that a little bit, please.
So I think that believing is a choice. I think there's always a lot of reasons for us not to believe. The world is hard. I think we're living in a very confusing time right now. On all levels, in all corners of our world, people are questioning and crying for change. And I want to be one of those people that inspires to believe in the middle of all of it. It brings people hope. It brings people sort of a call to action. And the music for me has always been that. It's a prayer. It's motion forward. It's a way to come together. And the title track and really the whole record are just pieces of that for me.
How have your experiences brought you to a place where you're able to be such a joyful voice for such a complex message?
I have no idea. I think I'm very lucky. A lot of people I see around me are bitter and sad. I'm sure we all have that in life. There are a lot of people who give up very easily. I've never been that person. I'm very blessed that I've always had belief. I've always believed that the light is coming. I've always believed that we have a chance if we only put ourselves wholeheartedly with everything we have into a place of goodness and love. And I don't know how I've been blessed. Actually, there are plenty of times in my life that I probably should have given up. And I'm really glad I didn't. I'm really glad that I stayed here. I'm glad that I can be that kind of artist and teacher and mother and partner. I'm glad that I can give something hopeful out to my audience. It's really my dream.
Do you sing to your kids?
I do. I do. All the time. They're the lights. And I have two sons from my first marriage, and my husband, we just got married last August, and he has three children. So we have a full house. And yes, singing here is of utmost importance.
I'm curious to hear what your longtime collaboration with a gospel choir means to you and how it began.
So several years ago, I was asked to sing a Martin Luther King event with this amazing choir. And when I walked into their church to rehearse with them, they were singing one of my father's songs. And it's an amazing thing. It was one of the first times that I'd ever been to a church because I was a sheltered Jewish girl, which is, you know, both beautiful and hard. And when I walked in, not only did I find, you know, Through the Air, the soundscape was one of the songs that I, you know, my most favorite songs growing up. But I also walked in and I found family. These people were my brothers and sisters. I just didn't know it yet. And we began to sing together and it sort of grew. And then we recorded together and we really had the opportunity to sing internationally. We made the Grammy Awards in 2011. It grew very organically and naturally from a place of true love, respect, and a love of God. And it's been one of the things that's inspired me most these last years. It's been, you know, nearly 13 years that I've been doing this work with these amazing people and really their family. And I think that that's really what propels me to continue to work with them. We realize that there are a lot of reasons why Baptists and Jews can be separated and kept apart, but we are choosing to love each other. We're choosing to worship together. And the prayer is that this is just a little snapshot of what the world could be if people choose. If you choose to love, if you choose to find common ground, you'll always find it.
What do you think we sacrifice when we stay in our separate silos?
I think when we put ourselves in boxes, whether they're self-imposed or religiously imposed, culturally imposed, I think we miss everything. We're not meant to be separated. We're meant to be one. And really, the moments in life where all of us are able to come together and find the common ground, those are the moments of real redemption. I was in New York right after 9/11, and where I lived on the Upper West Side, you could still smell the smoke. and it was horrifying, and nobody knew what to do. But I can tell you that everyone that I met in the street, everyone was clinging to each other and hugging each other, and it didn't matter who we were. It didn't matter that we were strangers. In that moment, we were all one heart working toward the same end, trying to help each other. And I really feel like that's what we're meant to do. That's why we're here. If we're not here to uplift each other, to light each other's lights and hold each other in joyous and complicated times, then why are we here? What are we giving our children? And I know I'm not alone in that thinking. I think that we need to come together and stop hurting each other, and stop hurting ourselves. We need to find a better way. Where we have been until now is just not working.
Have you always been the kind of bridge builder in your music and your activism?
No. I think when I began my career, I was one of the first Orthodox Jewish women to sing publicly for men. So even within my own world, my own Jewish world, I was very siloed and very, very sheltered. When I started to sing for other Orthodox people, I was not welcome because I was a woman. I've come a very far way since then, and I feel very blessed that the sort of the adversity that I have faced, the challenge that I have faced in my own career and my personal life, has inspired me not to fall apart, but to push harder and to pray harder and to sing louder. And thank you for saying that. That's a very deep compliment. I would like to be an advocate for change and an activist. I don't know that I've ever really, until now, ever saw myself that way.
Nashima, there can be no denying that this is a very dark time for a lot of people. Would you talk about where you find your hope? What inspires you the most?
I think everything inspires me. I am the happiest that I've ever been. People have said to me, "Oh, you know, you found your soulmate. So how special is that?" The truth is, I became my own soulmate. I became whole within myself, and from that place, I was able to find a really healthy, gorgeous relationship. So it's both of those things kind of happening at the same time, because I found myself and I found my greatest partner. So that's of deep inspiration. Our children together, the ups and downs of living in a blended family, it's gorgeous. Every minute of it is gorgeous. My own sons, who are just, they're just all things for me. Every minute, they're cute little things that they say, their little, you know, children's moments, that inspires me. Conversations with strangers inspires me. Putting my music out in the world and hearing back that there was somebody who was in the hospital with someone who was very ill and they were listening to my songs, I just cried. I'm so grateful that I have the ability to be close to people through this work. And I think the prayer, the greatest inspiring prayer for me, is that maybe it really does make a difference. That we can't really heal the world with one song, but we can try.
Nashima Kaliba is an award-winning musician as well as an activist and a teacher. Her new album is titled Believe. Nashima, thank you so much for spending time with us on State of Belief Radio. And can I ask you to just pick one more song for us to sample and tell us why you included it on this album?
Yeah, so this is the title track from Believe, called Believe, because for me, believing is all things. Even when the moments are hard, even when you have your dark times, when you hold to the fact that one day things will get better, that we will all find the light together, that's when we come through. So wherever you are, I hope you can sing with us to believe.
Time for one more break, and then clean water activist David Douglas on World Health Day, April 7th. I'm Welton Gaddy. You're listening to State of Belief Radio, brought to you by Interfaith Alliance. Right. Sunday, April 7th is World Health Day, designated as such by the World Health Organization. It's a day to look to the very real, often life-threatening challenges facing a great number of our fellow human beings across the world. To talk about the problems and the progress, I am really happy to be joined by activist and philanthropist David Douglas. David, thank you so much for being with us today.
I know, it's a delight to be with you, Welton. Thank you for the invitation.
How did you first come to activism around health issues in general and water safety in particular?
My wife and I live in Santa Fe, New Mexico, and I had been practicing environmental law, writing on environmental issues, and we were living at the time in an area above Santa Fe that lacked clean water, and we had a sick child one night, and I wondered, what would it be like to live in part of the world where, you know, we expected our water to come back on, you know, when the pump was fixed. But what would it be like to live in a part of the world where you can never count on clean water? How would you rehydrate a sick child? How would you clean her body? And I began to do some research and was stunned by the casualty toll that basically you had here the world's most serious public health problem that caused 20 related diseases, inadequate water and sanitation and hygiene, and yet it was not being written about very much. So I spent a number of years writing about the issue for religious magazines and environmental and developmental magazines, and that led me to starting a nonprofit that got water projects flowing in developing countries.
Mm. So really, you came out of a concern related to your family, and that turned into a kind of a spiritual journey that took you toward water.
It did, and a group of us eventually created the U.S.'s first advocacy organization for clean drinking water in developing countries in Washington, D.C. in 2005. And I asked fellow board members who set it up with me, how did you come to this issue? And almost everyone told a personal story of holding a child who was sick of a water-related disease, either one of their own or one that they had worked with abroad.
Mm-hmm. I am just stunned at how, I don't want to say ignorant, but I'm going to, how ignorant a lot of people are about the shortage of water in our world.
And it's not so much a shortage of absolute water. The water amount stays the same, but the problem tends to be where it's located, how clean it is, and whether in certain areas it's less reliable than it used to for a variety of reasons, including climate change. And so the when you look at the numbers of people without without water, it's about 780 million people. But if you actually ask how many are without safe water, the number triples. And that is not it's been an uphill effort to get attention to the issue. A number of other critical global health issues have received a tremendous amount of attention, and the water portion has received less. And I think that's changing just by the nature of the urgency of the issue.
You know, a lot of Americans care passionately about the well-being of the less fortunate, but don't go beyond making a charitable donation or two. Now, don't get me wrong, that's a wonderful thing to have happen, but I'm wondering if you might have some thoughts on what pushed you out of that kind of passive ally role into the level of activism that you've been engaged in now for years.
Right. I think part of it was, it went back to prayer, I think. I had been writing about the issue for a number of years, and at some point, one person who wrote, I remember a poet once said that in terms of getting the lack of attention that his poetry was getting, he said, publishing a volume of verse is like dropping a rose petal down the Grand Canyon and waiting for the echo.
Oh, and so my goodness.
At a period of time, I was actually praying, should we look for actually to be able to respond to a specific project? And there was a report in the Santa Fe New Mexican newspaper about a Sister of Charity nun whose village was suffering waterborne disease in Mexico. And we created a fund at our Presbyterian church. The first person to contribute to it was the Santa Fe's rabbi, and it was ecumenical, and the community in Mexico got water. And that was supposed to be one project, but that was a nonprofit we subsequently created called Water Lines. Eventually has helped now with over 1,000 water projects in developing countries.
I think there are so many misunderstandings about what can be done and what should be done when it comes to intervention and support from wealthy nations to less wealthy ones. So could you share a success story or two that would help make clear what can actually be achieved through concerted efforts?
Right. And one good example, I think, has been a number of schools in developing countries lack clean water and latrines and soap. And as a consequence, girls and boys often, but primarily it falls on young girls, have to carry water to school. Or they have latrines that don't work or no latrines at all, and they tend to drop out of school when they reached puberty. What we've seen has been very effective, and it was helped to UNICEF provided a key lead on this, and subsequently many nonprofit organizations and church groups and faith-based organizations have followed suit on this, is trying to both advocate at a high level with governments to increase funding for water for schools that lack clean water, but also work one-on-one. There's a wonderful organization called H2O for Life out of Minnesota that matches U.S. schools that can raise a modest amount of funding, oftentimes less than $5,000. And they match that with nonprofit organizations in developing countries that do the actual implementation at schools. And so the organization matches a U.S. school with an overseas school in Mali or Cambodia or Guatemala. And the children learn about each other, learn about both countries. And at the end of the day, the school in the developing country that did not have an adequate water supply has clean water. So it's on a very small scale, when you couple that with advocacy for helping to improve, you know, for example, the United States funding for clean water abroad, it touches both low and high.
Mm. Big picture, David, what do you see as the most urgent, achievable goals, and what regions are at the top of the list?
An advocacy effort that we've set up recently is called Global Water 2020 in D.C., and we set it up in part to address what I have come to think of as the most urgent and neglected part of the water crisis, the clean water crisis, particularly for human health. And it's designed to focus on the lack of clean water, sanitation, and hygiene in hospitals and clinics around the world. Just yesterday, UNICEF and the World Health Organization came out reconfirming the shocking statistics about the number of healthcare facilities, these are hospitals and clinics, in sub-Saharan Africa and parts of Asia, parts of Latin America, that don't have clean water. And think for a minute of what it's like. Most of your listeners will have spent some time in a hospital. Mm-hmm. And for all of us to imagine what it is like to go to a hospital where there is not only sometimes no clean water, but no water whatsoever, except for that's been brought up by jerry cans on by donkeys from the nearest river. Mm-hmm. And that for the majority of healthcare facilities in developing countries, they lack the three key essentials of global health: clean water, functioning latrines, and the presence of soap. And everything else that we're trying to do in global health when it comes to infectious disease, whether it's stopping pandemic diseases abroad that could spread to America, whether it's dealing with maternal and child health or antimicrobial resistance or safe surgery, infection prevention control, all that is at stake unless the foundation of global public health, which is really water sanitation and hygiene in healthcare facilities, is addressed. And the situation is grave and it's eminently solvable. We're not waiting for any technological breakthrough on this. No discoveries. You know, it's people know what needs to be done. It's a matter of political will and I think spiritual will at the same time to deal with this problem.
Have you seen progress in the understanding of how fundamental these issues are at the level of the UN and other institutions?
Yes, and that's what I think is so hopeful. I mean, there's a lot of reasons to be discouraged in a lot of different areas of public life, but I think people are coming together. I think you mentioned at the top there's a bipartisan support among all groups for this kind of basic health, and we've seen the United Nations come together. The UN Secretary General issued a call to action on this issue of lack of WASH. That's the acronym for water sanitation and hygiene, is WASH, in hospitals and clinics last year. The Vatican just came out 2 weeks ago with a call to prioritize adequate water and sanitation and hygiene in all Catholic-run healthcare facilities, which is would be a huge step. In some developing countries, faith-based facilities need a tremendous amount of help in getting adequate clean water and sanitation and hygiene. Even more serious are oftentimes government-run facilities. But what we're seeing in our the USAID and Global Water 2020 next Tuesday, will be convening the first gathering of all major faith-based organizations running or involved with healthcare facilities in developing countries to see what more can be done on this issue. And so I find it very hopeful that everyone is ratcheting up their concern for this issue, and not just in words, but in actual response.
Oh, that's great to hear. David, I have to ask how concerned you are about the impact global climate change is likely to have on whatever progress is being made right now. Is it even possible to make allowances for what's likely to happen in the next decade or two?
No, it's a great question, and the consequences are the current situation is a crisis situation, given the number of people that today lack these essential, the clean water, that have never had a glass of clean water in their lives. And they're dealing with this. Literally, billions of people are suffering from diseases caused by inadequate WASH, water sanitation, and hygiene today. So the prospect of climate change is already causing additional problems where there is additional scarcity of clean water available. And what I think is particularly hard is to have people, leaders of faith in our own country, in the United States. I'm a Christian, and to hear fellow Christians deny the science that makes it clear that this is happening and there are things that we can do about it, and not seeming to understand the particular impact that this is going to have on the poor and the vulnerable, and in the situation of hospitals that don't have clean water, the sick, is very troubling. And I hope all of us can search our consciences more deeply to figure out that there are ways that we need to respond, and denial is not one of them.
What else would you like our listeners to keep in mind on this World Health Day, April 7th, and Is there something you would like to encourage everyone to read or learn more about in connection with this occasion?
Oh, thank you for that question. I think to understand that there's something that everyone can do, whether it's supporting specific projects, whether it's writing their legislator to help increase funding for water abroad. It's one of the most popular issues on Capitol Hill because it's so bipartisan. Everybody gets the issue, but that the letters are always helpful. Working within their faith communities to support water issues abroad. Many faith organizations have hunger task forces. Very few have water task forces. Mm-hmm. And to remind ourselves that almost every faith tradition has water as a central element of importance, as part of creation, and to see it as something that unifies each ourselves politically and or spiritually and politically, and I think to and prayer. I would not omit, but I think that's really where it begins. I mean, for each person to pray to determine how they might respond to this critical health issue.
David Douglas is a longtime activist and philanthropist who has founded and or led such organizations as Waterlines, which specializes in small-scale drinking water projects worldwide, Water Advocates and Advocates for Development Assistance, both based in Washington, D.C., and Global Water 2020. Thank you so much for being with us today on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you so much. I greatly appreciate it.
Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. If you've made a donation to State of Belief Radio this week, let me say a sincere thank you. You've helped put us on the air this week. Your generous support of this program is vital for us being here every week. If you think there's value in what you've heard here, and you think it's important that others hear it as well, please make your contribution today. Find more information at stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. Stay up to date by subscribing to the free weekly State of Belief podcast on iTunes or your favorite podcast platform. And take a moment to follow us on Facebook and Twitter and be a part of the conversation. Our producer is Ray Kirstein. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. And be sure to join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief.
I think it's time we stop. Children, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going down.